It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2019, the Allegheny County Department of Human Services identified nearly 1,000 young adults who were living on the street, in shelters, or were identified as being at imminent risk of homelessness. Now the department says it's expanding its housing and support services for young adults ages 18 through 24 who are experiencing housing insecurity. Laura Solly is the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program Manager. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Laura, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, the number of Pennsylvanians without stable housing has actually decreased over the last decade. Can you give us what the situation overall here in the Pittsburgh region is?
Well, we did a comprehensive analysis back at the beginning of 2020 when we started planning out how we were going to expand our youth homelessness response system. And we found that in that previous year, Allegheny County had 343 young adults who had experienced what's referred to as literal homelessness. So staying in a shelter, sleeping out of doors, or staying in some kind of place that's not meant for human habitation. And then in addition, there was another 573 youth who were in that imminent risk of homelessness or unstably housed category. Mm-hmm. So couch surfing, staying somewhere, but being told that they had to pack up and leave. While the numbers may have gone down in the state, you know, we still have a critical issue to deal with here in Allegheny County.
Allegheny County is one of 24 counties nationwide given grants through the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program. Allegheny County, you got $3.5 million. So what kind of programs is this funding? Are they new to the county, an expansion of existing ones?
Yeah, it's actually a mix of both, which is pretty cool. So before we ever determined how we were going to spend the funding, the first thing that we did was we gathered a group of community stakeholders. And at the center was young adults who have lived experience with homelessness and housing instability. We took all of that feedback. We had about 30 different partner agencies. Mm-hmm. So one of the big things that we took away was we actually do have a really resource-rich community, and we have a number of initiatives that are working really well. We just didn't have enough to meet the demand. So one of the models that has been really evidence-based and really effective, not only in our community, but across the country, is rapid rehousing.
It provides built-in peer support and shared housing. What are the benefits of that?
The benefits of shared housing are, you know, definitely combating some of the isolation that young people can feel when they do move into housing after a period of homelessness. What we're trying to do with some of our new programming is make that shared housing piece a really strong component. So rather than thinking about helping a 19-year-old get into an apartment on their own, you know, thinking about helping a 19-year-old connect with another young person that maybe they could share the cost and make housing a lot more sustainable and affordable while also having that built-in support network.
Right. So the housing is the key component, but what are the services that are involved, whether it's training or education, or does it go beyond just sheltering?
We know that, you know, for some people, the causes of homelessness can be really varied and complex. It's usually not just one thing that led to housing instability. It might be a few different things. And so that means that the folks who are working with young households need to be really good at engaging, understanding what's been going on in their lives, and then helping them connect to whatever resources are going to be most effective at not only solving the immediate housing crisis, but helping with long-term stability.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to the county's coordinated community plan to prevent and end youth homelessness, Black youth and LGBTQIA plus youth are more likely to experience homelessness. How is that taken into account or considered when you design these programs?
This intersects with the conversation about race equity, LGBTQIA equity. We're looking for things like making sure that programs hire individuals who reflect the population to be served, that there's diversity at all levels within the organization, that staff have cultural competency training and are really prepared with the right resources to engage a very diverse population.
How do you account for social, emotional needs, not just housing?
That's a really big focus of all of the YHDP work. And so in trying to set up more shared housing arrangements, that's one of the ways that we're attempting to really bolster social supports. One of the other strategies that we're really amplifying is prevention and diversion work. So, you know, when somebody is facing imminent risk of homelessness before they ever enter the homeless system. We have teams that are trained to talk to people and really identify who are their natural supports, who are the go-to people that they trust. Is there some possibility of working with that person to set up some safe housing in the meantime?
Laura, has the pandemic complicated any of the county's plans?
Yeah, the COVID-19 crisis, it hasn't slowed down our progress in implementing new programs. But in terms of the impact that it's had on young adults experiencing homelessness, it's been a really profound impact, especially around, you know, issues of employment. We know that young adults tend to work in service industry jobs, and so many of those employers have been dramatically affected.
Are these programs being phased in? Are they in place? If not yet, when?
Some of our programs are up and running. The Rapid Rehousing Program that I spoke about, we have programming that is available now. There's a new program that we're doing in partnership with Auberly that's called the HOPE Project, and that is really focused on helping those who are tenuously housed, couch surfing. They can access a lot of different supports to help stabilize their housing or access other alternative housing. One of the new programs that is getting ramped up that I'm really excited about is called Host Homes, and that is a partnership with an agency called Valley Youth House. And this is an effort that really relies on volunteers in the community who are interested in opening up their homes to a young person in need. Hosts go through a really rigorous vetting and screening process just to make sure they're prepared to offer a great environment for a young person to stay while they figure out long-term housing. So it's meant to be, you know, a few weeks to a few months. That program is actively recruiting volunteers. And so if anybody listening is interested, we'd love to encourage them to reach out to Valley Youth House to learn more.
Laura Solly is the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program Manager at Allegheny County's Department of Human Services. Laura, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Late last year, two feature films with strong ties to the Pittsburgh region debuted on streaming services. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Netflix, based on the August Wilson play, and Happiest Season on Hulu, a romantic comedy based in our city. Unfortunately, because of the pandemic, almost all films were watched from home instead of in theaters. With fewer theaters open and available for patrons, how is the city's slice of film industry production faring? Well, to answer that question, we've turned to Don Keyser, director of the Pittsburgh Film Office. Don, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Don, is it kind of sad when films based in, produced in Pittsburgh, aren't really shown in Pittsburgh in the traditional sense?
It was sad because, especially in terms of Ma Rainey, which is getting so much Oscar buzz. But on the other hand, it was kind of fun because it opened up to a lot more people being able to see it from the comfort of their home. And it seemed to get a lot of attention that way, too. So we're sad we didn't get to celebrate with our friends, but we know that everyone got to sit at home and watch it, too. So that was good.
Do you think a movie premiering on a streaming platform, premiering at a theater, that they draw the same attention, different opportunities? What?
Well, I think it's different attention. It's interesting because we had three come out all within 2 weeks of each other. So Happiest Season kicked it off, and that was the Sony show that ended up, that would have been a big screen premiere, ended up on Hulu. Then Ma Rainey, Black Bottom, which, as we talked about, is getting lots of Oscar buzz. And then we had a third one, which is I Am Your Woman, that came out on Amazon. And it really got a lot of more attention, I think, because of the Amazon Prime memberships and people's ability just to click and go, oh, hey, wait, this was filmed in Pittsburgh. And it brought some more attention to the industry, which is great to have.
I'm sure we're all a bit guilty of this. Instead of watching maybe a new release, the critically acclaimed film, we might turn to a show or film maybe we've seen before that gives us some comfort, especially during this pandemic. So is there a concern that film risks falling through the cracks on a streaming platform?
I'm guilty of it, too. I have to tell you, my confession, I'm a huge Grey's Anatomy fan, have watched it from the beginning. And when they brought back McSteamy and McDreamy and, you know, they started bringing back, I felt like I was home, right? So then I go back searching for some of the old episodes to watch again. I think that happens. But people are craving something new. They want to see something different. And thankfully, we had three shows come out that they could look at and go, oh, wait, that's Pittsburgh. And they could look for their friends and look for locations they recognized.
The pandemic, I mean, it's been going on for more than 10 months. We spoke in early summer, and you expected production to really ramp up in early fall. Then we saw another surge in COVID cases. What's the status of film production, the film industry here now?
Well, thankfully, because of our clients, our largest client currently is Netflix, they've been able to get people back to work safely. So we have a series called Archive that's been in production for about a month now. They have their own full-on testing capabilities. They have a compliance, COVID compliance safety team, and they've been able to get people safely back to work in a manner that everyone feels secure and they can work, which is thrilling because at one point, like most of the state, we had a lot of people unemployed. There's 15,000 people that work in this industry on a full-time basis statewide, and everyone was out of work. So we have Archive, which is shooting and put a lot of people back to work. We have a second Netflix show that's in prep, which will start filming in February. And then finally, and thankfully, Showtime's coming back with the Jeff Daniels show called Rust, which is a show that was set in Allegheny County and Fayette County. Took us 3 years to get here to the region. And they were supposed to start principal photography on March 16th, 2020, which coincided with the shutdown orders statewide.
Other than those, and that's promising, are there fewer projects going on, though?
Well, we typically are running about five shows at a time, but due to the underfunded film tax credit program, these are the three we had, and we're happy to have them. We'd love to see more. I'm still getting calls. People are wanting to know what we're looking like for the summer, what we're looking like for the fall. I would say the industry is very optimistic, especially with the vaccines on the horizon for the bulk of the population, that they're going to be up and running and get everyone back to work quickly. The nice thing about the film industry is it uses so many small businesses to keep itself going when it's on location in places like Pittsburgh. And we're really pushing to hopefully increase the film tax credit in this next budget cycle to accommodate the pent-up demand and need to create more production.
So you expect that you always run out of film tax credits practically immediately. Do you expect that sort of positive approach, that demand to continue?
I do expect it to continue because we're already getting phone calls. And the industry, you know, they had projects ready to go. If COVID hadn't happened, there would have been a much bigger demand for the limited tax credits we have in the Commonwealth. But now they're all like, okay, look, if everyone gets a vaccine by summer, we should be able to get back to work. So what's your program looking at? What can we do? Do you have room for us? Which is always my favorite question.
Don Keyser is the director of the Pittsburgh Film Office. Don, as always, thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Something new about something tens of millions of years old. A multinational team of researchers has announced the discovery of a dinosaur preserved sitting atop a nest of its own eggs that included fossilized babies inside. The scientific paper was recently published in the journal Science Bulletin. The research team includes Matt LaManna. He is Associate Curator of Vertebrate and Paleontology and the Interim Director of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Matt, welcome back to The Confluence.
Oh, thanks very much, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Matt, I understand that fossilized dinosaur eggs have been found on just about every continent, but a fossil of a dinosaur sitting on its own eggs, how rare is that?
There have only been a few instances of anyone finding what we call a non-avian dinosaur, what people would traditionally think of as a dinosaur, fossilized atop a nest of its own eggs. The unique thing about our discovery is that it's the first time that we've got a dinosaur fossilized atop its nest, and the nest definitely contains embryos.
So 70 million years old, the dinosaur is an oviraptorid. I see raptor in that name, which has caught a lot of people's attention anytime we hear that word raptor. So can you give us an idea what it looked like?
Many people think Velociraptor from Jurassic Park, and this dinosaur would be a distant relative of Velociraptor, but it would have had some characteristics in common. an oviraptorid would have sort of a vaguely chicken or turkey-like head with a toothless beak and very probably a bony crest on its head, something like the modern cassowary bird. Mm-hmm. So think like something like the head of a chicken with the body of a velociraptor, and you'd be in a pretty decent ballpark.
In the paper that was published, you wrote that this animal was exhibiting a brooding posture. Why is that significant?
The brooding posture is significant because there's been some doubt as to whether dinosaurs cared for their eggs in the way that modern birds do. And so what's really cool about this new discovery, it adds another piece to the puzzle. It adds another piece of evidence in support of the brooding hypothesis.
Now, you said that the fossilized embryos were at various stages of development. Wouldn't they all be sort of around the same stage if they were in one group of eggs that were laid at the same time?
That could be a consequence of a number of things. It could be differences in proximity to the adult. In other words, the eggs that were closest to the adult would have gotten the most warmth and therefore developed the fastest. In my mind, it's also possible that oviraptorids may have nested colonially, where multiple females will contribute to the nest at slightly different times, and then the nest is guarded by, in the case of ostriches, a single adult male.
What does this mean for the evolution of reproductive biology?
It's long been suspected that brooding behavior evolved in non-avian dinosaurs, and this particular discovery adds even more weight to that hypothesis. It provides yet another piece of evidence in favor of the idea that, you know, when you see a chicken sitting on its nest, that's not something that birds evolved on their own. It's something that they inherited from their dinosaur ancestors that had already evolved it beyond 66 million years ago.
The fossil that was discovered and reported on also brought insights into the diet of this chicken-headed velociraptor covered with feathers. It seems like a lot of new information from just one fossil. Is every discovery this enlightening?
No, so this is super, super extraordinary. I mean, like, the fact that it was sitting atop a nest. The nest is full of eggs. The eggs have embryos inside. The adult has a cluster of stomach stones or gastroliths inside its belly. The first time that's ever been found with an oviraptorid, at least to my knowledge. This particular fossil is certainly one of the most informative fossils that I've ever worked on in my life.
Matt LaManna is the interim director and associate curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Congratulations on the discovery, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Thanks for having me, and I'll hope to talk to you again soon.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.